treats answers as data. She is effectively checking for understanding. In this case, the technique involves using a simple but powerful analytical framework to assess answers. Sampling. Sampling means asking iterations of a single question or a set of similar questions to a smaller group of students and using the answers as representative of a larger group's answers. The sample is a set of data points, each viewed independently and explicitly used for analysis. The point is that the questions and answers may, sometimes, be the same as in any other class. The technique lies in how you think about them. Here are four more specific ways to make your questioning more data-driven. Data sets. We tend to think of any single answer as reflective of where the class is at any given time. But a single answer can come from anywhere on a curve of student mastery, from low to high, and you will often have no idea where. Not only that, but even if you knew a question was reflective of the class mean, you'd want to think of how much information is hidden by an average. What's the highest level of mastery? The lowest? How spread out are students in their level of mastery? Are most students very similar to the student at the mean, or widely dispersed in their level of knowledge? No single question can resolve these critical questions. Instead, you should reflect on your questions in groups and think of them, as the second teacher above did, as data sets. If you ask five students similar questions or different questions on a similar topic, assess them as a group. What's the hit rate? Percentage correct. This gives you far better information than does thinking of your questions as a progression of singular data points. By thinking of your questions as data sets, you come to realize that wrong, 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 right is a bad sequence, not a good one. It also tells you that wrong, right is not enough data. You should keep asking so you know whether you're dealing with wrong, right, 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 or wrong, right, wrong, wrong. Statistical sampling. As you ask questions in sets, think about taking a statistical sample of the room. If you're asking your class five questions to test whether they understand how to find the least common denominator, ask a sample of students from across the spectrum of likely skill. Two typically low-performing students, two middle students, and one high performer. Now you'll have better information about how far into the class the mastery you've tried to build has spread. Obviously, to be able to do this, you need to choose who answers, not the kids. So cold calling, calling on whom you want without regard to whose hand is raised, is a critical technique to use. Cold call is technique 22 in chapter 4. Reliability. Any right answer always poses the risk of its being a false positive, a lucky correct guess. Therefore, stop teaching when your students get it right several times in a row, not once. To ensure reliability, the likelihood of future correct answers on similar questions, respond to right answers with follow-up why and how questions as often as you can. See Stretch It, Technique 3. This gives you the best data on whether a student would be likely to get a similar problem right the next time around. If he or she can't clearly explain it, the risk of a lucky guess is high. Validity. Make sure that the question you get a positive result to is an effective measure of what students have to master to be successful. You have to measure what you say you're measuring. Therefore, you should carefully align the questions you ask to check for understanding on the rigor and style of questions your students will ultimately be accountable for. You should make them sound like, and be at least as hard as, what students will see on the final exam, the state assessment, or whatever else your bottom line measure is. Especially data-driven teachers often insert a short verbal quiz into the fabric of their lesson to increase the amount and usefulness of the data they collect. James Verrilli, principal at North Star Academy in Newark, New Jersey, calls this dipsticking. When he teaches, he samples a wide range of students on a set of similar questions about a common topic to gauge the level of mastery of the whole class. Types of questions. Although you can use check for understanding without changing the format of the questions you ask, thinking about answers as data will probably change your questions. You're likely to ask far fewer yes or no questions, since with only two possible answers, they give a far higher possible rate of false positives. You're likely to have to learn to be more cognizant of tipping, giving the answers away in your question, as in this sequence. Teacher. Who can tell me what the phrase off the deep end means? Student. It means someone is upset? Teacher. Well, are they a little upset or like really, really upset? Student. Really, really upset. Teacher. Good. In this case, it's hard to imagine the student who thinks the answer is a little bit upset. Finally, you'll probably come to rely a lot less on self-report, a method teachers use frequently. Thumbs up if you get this, thumbs down if you don't. Aficionados of data know self-report to be chronically unreliable. Observation. Observation is the second way to determine whether students understand a concept, and it addresses a key validity challenge. When you test for mastery using questioning, you don't take into account the fact that students can often answer correctly verbally but not in writing. Observation allows you to see written answers before you sign off. Furthermore, observation, which involves circulating when students are doing independent seat work to observe mastery levels, requires a larger total investment of time but allows you to see more data points more rapidly during that time. Like questioning, this skill does not so much involve changing activities as it does thinking of the information in front of you through the data lens. Instead of circulating to see how close to finished students are or whether they are working, you would specifically look for the number and type of errors they are making, possibly even tracking them on a short response sheet so you can organize and refer back to the data later. One way to increase your capacity to gather useful data through observation is to standardize the format of what you're looking at. If you're looking for information in the same place on each student's paper, for example, you'll find it much more quickly and will be able to retain your concentration on comparing answers across students, not finding them for single students. Giving out packets is an effective way to do this. If you plan the work you want students to do during your lesson in advance, writing out the problems or questions in order in a packet that each student picks up at the beginning of class, you know that when you want to see how many students can find the least common denominator of 28 and 77, it will always be at the top of the third page of every student's packet. You've minimized the number of unimportant things you have to process so you can concentrate on what's important. You can take this a step further by providing clear spaces for work to be done or answers to be written. Incidentally, this method works in all subject areas, albeit slightly differently. If you are reading a novel, for example, you might ask students to underline the place where the protagonist's motivation is revealed and write "key indicator of motivation" in the margin. Then it would be easy for you to check for understanding even while students read. Or if you didn't want to be as prescriptive, you might ask your students to write a one-sentence summary of each page in a novel at the top of that page. Then you could choose a relevant page and quickly find and compare all summaries in your classroom to better assess the data. Another way to increase your capacity to gather observable data is to use slates. You can quickly check the whole class's comprehension by giving your students tools to write down their answers and quickly hold them up to you. Some teachers use scrap paper, and others get mini dry erase boards for their students. You can even use the worksheets or packets your students are completing by simply saying, "Show me," and then circulating to observe. The trick isn't so much in the tool you use to gather, but in the way you gather and respond to the information. Be sure to observe all students' answers. Be sure that students can't cheat by observing others' answers before writing their own. Be sure your questions assess mastery effectively and not superficially. Asking students to use nonverbal signals to show their answer to a series of questions, one finger up if you got A, two up if you got B, can provide an effective and simpler variation on the theme. Just be aware of the ability of students to hide their lack of knowledge by piggybacking. Responding to data. The second part of check for understanding involves responding to the data you collect. It's worth noting that all the recognition in the world won't help if it does not result in action. Generally, teachers are better at checking for than acting on gaps in student mastery, so the imperative is not only to act, but to act quickly. The shorter the delay between recognizing a gap in mastery and taking action to fix it, the more likely the intervention is to be effective. There are exceptions. Sometimes you need to identify a small group of students to receive tutoring outside class, but it's important to recognize the timeliness of knowledge that students haven't mastered a concept. There's no sense pushing on to harder material when you know students can't do the simpler work. There's no sense reading on in the novel when there's a persistent misunderstanding about what's happening at the outset. Stop and fix it, then move on. This also makes sense because the sooner you fix it, the simpler the misunderstanding is likely to be. When an error is compounded by 3 days or 3 hours of subsequent misunderstandings, it's likely to be complex and thorny. The root cause will take time to figure out, and you will need a full lesson to reteach it. It's far better to act quickly and solve learning problems while they are simple and can be addressed with an additional problem, a short activity, or a re-explanation that takes 3 minutes rather than 35. You can take action in response to data in numerous ways. Teachers sometimes forget the benefit of reteaching material in a slightly different way from the first time. Repeating what you did before might work, but it assumes there aren't kids who would respond to something slightly different. This doesn't mean that you go back and try a whole new method for teaching long division, for example. You really should decide on the best way to do that. But you can explain it in slightly different words or with different examples. Here are several other actions to take in response to data telling you that student mastery is incomplete. Reteach using a different approach. Reteach by identifying and reteaching the problem step. I think the place we're struggling is when we get to remainders. So let's work on that a little more. Reteach by identifying and explaining difficult terms. I think the term denominator is giving us some trouble. Reteach at a slower pace. Let's read that list of words again. I'm going to go really slowly, and I want you to make sure you hear me read the suffixes. Then I'm going to ask you to... Reteach using a different order. Let's try to put the key events in the story in reverse order this time. Reteach identifying students of concern. We're going to push on to the problems in your packet now, but I want a couple of you to come work with me at the front. If I say your name, bring your packet up here. Or meet me at lunch. Reteach using more repetitions. It seems that we're able to identify the genre most of the time, but let's try to get a bit more practice. I'm going to read you the first two sentences to 10 imaginary stories. For each one, write down the genre you think it is and one reason for your answer. Technique 19. At-bats. Many years ago at a school where I used to teach, I was assigned to coach baseball, a sport I'd played only casually and felt unqualified to coach. A friend of a friend was a master baseball coach, however, and I got an hour of his time over coffee to figure out how to organize my practices. His biggest piece of advice was both simple and enduring and is key to the at-bats technique. Teach them the basics of how to hit and then get them as many at-bats as you can. Practice after practice, swing after swing after swing. Maximize the number of at-bats. Let them do it over and over again until they can swing quick and level in their sleep. That's the key. Don't change it. Don't get too fancy. Give them at-bats. At-bats, it turned out, were the key to hitting. Sometimes the obvious truths are the best ones, and in fact this truth is reaffirmed by the data in just about every field and every situation. Want to know what single factor best predicts the quality of a surgeon? It's not her reputation, not the place where she went to medical school, not even how smart she is. The best predictor is how many surgeries of a particular type she's done. It's muscle memory. It's repetition. It's at-bats. For complex surgery, hitting baseballs, solving math problems, writing sentences. Repetition is the key for a surgeon, not just because it means she'll be smoothest when things go as expected, but because if things go wrong, she'll have the most brain power left over to engage in problem-solving in the moment. With her clamping and cutting skills refined to automaticity, she'll calmly have all her faculties to focus on how to respond to the critical and unexpected event. Nothing inscribes and refines a skill so that it can be reliably applied under any circumstances, like at-bats. So great lessons should have plenty of them. And if it's true that people master a new skill on the 10th or 20th or 1,000th time they do it, never the first time, it's important to factor that into your lessons. Once your students get to you, once they're doing independent work, they need lots and lots of practice. 10 or 20 repetitions instead of 2 or 3. This is especially important to remember because in the busy day, sufficient repetition is the first thing to go. We teach all the way to the part where students can ingrain the skill, and we stop. They try it once, and we say, good, you've got it. Or worse, we're running out of time. Try it at home and make sure you've got it. A lesson should end with students getting at bat after at bat after at bat. It should often begin with a few at bats on previous material, cumulative review. Here are the key points to remember. Go until they can do it on their own. By the end of independent practice, students should be able to solve problems to the standard they'll be accountable for and entirely on their own. Use multiple variations and formats. Students should be able to solve questions in multiple formats and a significant number of plausible variations and variables. Grab opportunities for enrichment and differentiation. As some students demonstrate mastery faster than others, be sure to have bonus problems ready for them to push them to the next level. Technique 20. Exit ticket. End your lesson with a final at-bat, a single question or maybe short sequence of problems to solve at the close of class. When you collect this from students before they leave and cull the data, it's an exit ticket. Not only will this establish a productive expectation about daily completed work for students, but it will ensure that you always check for understanding in a way that provides you with strong data and thus critical insights. What percentage of your students got it right? What mistake did those who got it wrong make? Why, in looking at their errors, did they make that mistake? What about your lesson might have led to the confusion? Not only will you know how to refine the next lesson, but you'll no longer be flying blind. You'll know how effective your lesson was, as measured by how well they learned it, not how well you thought you taught it. Some thoughts on effective exit tickets. They're quick, 1 to 3 questions. Honestly, that's it. It's not a unit quiz. You want to get a good idea of how your kids did on the core part of your objective with 10 minutes of analysis afterward. They're designed to yield data. This means the questions are fairly simple and focus on one key part of the objective. That way, if students get them wrong, you'll know why. If you ask a multi-step problem, you may not know which part they didn't get. They also tend to vary formats, one multiple choice and one open response, say. You need to know that students can solve both ways. They make great do-nows. See technique number 29 in chapter 5. After you've looked at the data, let your students do the same. Start the next day's lesson by analyzing and reteaching the exit ticket when students struggle. Technique 21. Take a stand. This technique involves pushing students to actively engage in the ideas around them by making judgments about the answers their peers provide. This can allow you to increase the number of students who participate in and process a particular part of your lesson. For example, you might ask your class to respond to an answer as Rochester Prep's Bob Zimmerly does. 2 snaps if you agree, 2 stomps if you don't. One student answers, but every student has to decide if the answer is right, and to do that, they have to solve. Done right, this increases your ratio by a factor of about 25. Take-a-stand techniques can be whole class, stand up if you agree with Alexis, or directed to an individual. She said 9 times 9 is 81. That's not right, is it, Valeria? They can be evaluative. How many people think Deshaun is right? Or analytical. How could she check her work to see if she's right, Elena? Finally, they can be verbal or signaled through a gesture. Show me on your hands how big the remainder is. Show me on your hands which answer choice you think is correct. Some teachers have students put their heads down to ensure they can't see one another's responses when they take a stand, or write on scraps of paper or small dry erase boards. Take a stand helps students process more content, and it helps you check for understanding. How indicative of the rest of the class was the original student's answer? Which wrong answer did those who got it wrong choose? Furthermore, since using take-a-stand techniques means explicitly asking one student to evaluate another's answer, is he right, James? How many people got the same answer as Ty? The technique brings student answers to the forefront of class. It makes them appear to be as fundamental to the work of learning as are teacher-given answers, and underscores the value teachers put on student responses. When you ask your students to take a stand, be careful not to let the exercise become cursory. There are plenty of classrooms where teachers routinely ask students to agree or disagree, or to do thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways. The key to maximum effect is not so much asking whether students agree, but following up on their answers to inform your teaching and make students accountable for mentally engaged judgments, rather than empty and obligatory participation. To make the technique effective, you should, with predictable consistency, not every time perhaps, but fairly reliably, ask students to defend or explain their positions. Why is your thumb down, Keisha? You can raise your hand easily enough. The key is to make sure that students are truly doing cognitive work when they do so. And to do that, you have to check up on their answers. It's also important to remember to have students take a stand both when the original answer was right and when it was wrong, and to avoid letting the method you use tip students off. One teacher I know always asks students, two snaps if you agree, two stomps if you don't, when the answer was right, and raise your hand if you got the same answer when it was wrong. This quickly took all of the intellectual work out of the exercise. To make this technique succeed, you also have some cultural work to do in making sure that your students are comfortable exposing and discussing their own errors. Stomping when others are snapping, or keeping three fingers up when others have four, and then in telling you openly about what they thought and why. Be sure to praise and acknowledge students as they do this. You might say, "Thank you for stomping, Turin. I appreciate that you took the risk of challenging us. Now let's figure out why you didn't agree," on the front end. Or, after this example, "Let's have two snaps and two stomps for Turin for pushing us all to think." Reflection and practice. The following activities should help you think about and practice the techniques in this chapter. 1. Choose one of the following deliberately informal topics and sketch out a lesson plan that follows an I, we, you structure. In fact, you can go one step further by planning a 5-step process. I do you help, you do, I help, you do, and do and do and do. You don't have to assume you'll be teaching your actual students. Students will be able to shoot an accurate foul shot. Students will be able to write the name of their school in cursive. Students will be able to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Students will understand and apply the correct procedure for doing laundry in your household. Students will be able to change a tire. Now, take your lesson and design a 3 to 5 minute hook that engages students and sets up the lesson. 3. Be sure to name the steps in the I portion of your lesson. Review them and find 4 or 5 ways to make them stickier. 4. Identify the 2 or 3 places in your lesson where students are most likely to make an error or misunderstand the lesson. Script break-it-down questions at varying levels of support for each of these likely error points. 5. Assign an exit ticket that will allow you to accurately assess student knowledge at the end of the lesson. Chapter 4. Engaging students in your lessons. Great teachers engage students so that they feel like part of the lesson. They make a habit of focused involvement in the classroom. While that may already sound easier said than done with the most resistant students, it's doubly challenging since students need to be engaged in not just the class, but in the work of the class. That is, you could easily engage students in class by substituting frills for substance. The techniques reviewed in this chapter will consistently draw students into the work of class and keep them focused on learning. Technique 22. Cold call. When calling on students during class, it's natural to think about managing who gets to participate and think, how do I give everyone a chance? Whose turn is it? Or who will give me the answer I want? However, a more important question to ask is, how can I adapt my decisions about which students I call on to help all my students pay better attention? The idea, of course, is that you want everybody to pay attention and develop a system that ensures that all students think it's possible that they are about to be called on, regardless of whether they have raised their hand, and therefore think they must therefore prepare to answer. You need a system that ensures that instead of one student answering each of your questions, all of your students answer all of your questions in their minds, with you merely choosing one student to speak the answer out loud. Cold call is that system. When you cold call, you call on students regardless of whether they have raised their hands. It's deceptively simple. You ask a question and then call the name of the student you want to answer it. If students see you frequently and reliably calling on classmates who don't have their hand raised, they will come to expect it and prepare for it. Calling on whomever you choose regardless of whether the students hand up also brings several other critical benefits to your classroom. First, it allows you to check for understanding effectively and systematically. It's critical to be able to check what any student's level of mastery is at any time, regardless of whether he or she is offering to tell you. In fact, it's most important when he or she is not offering to tell you. Cold call allows you to check on exactly the student you want to check in on to assess mastery. And the technique makes this process seem normal. When students are used to being asked to participate or answer by their teacher, they react to it as if it were a normal event. And this allows you to get a focused, honest answer and therefore check for understanding reliably. This means that while using cold call to assist you in checking for understanding is critical, you'll also do best if you use it before you need to check for understanding. Your goal is to normalize it as a natural and normal part of your class, preferably a positive one. Second, cold call increases speed in both the terms of your pacing, the illusion of speed, and the rate at which you can cover material, real speed. To understand the degree to which this is so, make an audio tape of your lesson sometime. Use a stopwatch to track how much time you spend waiting and encouraging and cajoling and asking for volunteers. With cold call, you no longer have a delay after you ask, "Can anyone tell me what one cause of World War I was?" You no longer have to scan the room and wait for hands. You no longer have to dangle hints to encourage participants or tell your students that you'd like to see more hands. Instead of saying, "I'm seeing the same four hands. I want to hear from more of you. Doesn't anyone else know this?" You simply say, "Tell us one cause of World War I, please." Slight pause here. Darren? With cold call, you'll move through material much faster, and the tedious, momentum-sapping mood when no one appears to want to speak up will disappear. These two results will increase your pacing, the illusion of speed you create in your classroom, which is a critical factor in how students engage. See Chapter 3 for more on pacing. Third, cold call allows you to distribute work more broadly around the room and signal to students not only that they are likely to be called on to participate, and therefore that they should engage in the work of the classroom, but that you want to know what they have to say. You care about their opinion. Many students have insight to add to your class, but will not offer it unless you push or ask. They wonder if anyone really cares what they think, or they think it's just as easy to keep their thoughts to themselves because Charlie's hand is always up anyway. Or they have a risky and potentially valuable thought on the tip of their tongue, but aren't quite sure enough of it to say it aloud yet. Sometimes there will even be a glance, a moment when this student looks at you as if to say, "Should I?" Or maybe even, "Just call on me so you've shared responsibility if this is totally off the mark." Many people mistakenly perceive cold calling to be chastening and stressful. When it's done right, it's an extremely powerful and positive way to reach out to kids who want to speak, but are reluctant to be hand raisers. It says, "I want to hear what you say," even if Charlie's hand is up for the 10th time in 12 questions. Fourth, cold call will help you distribute work around the room not only more fully, that is, beyond the hand raisers, but more authoritatively. One of its positive effects is that it establishes that the room belongs to you. Not only will this allow you to reach out to individual students, but it will have a strong cultural effect in that it will draw out engagement. If I am pretty sure that at some point in the next few hours or day, you're going to call on me to respond to our classwork, I have a strong incentive to do that work in anticipation of this probability. You have made me accountable. This is an incredibly powerful force. People sometimes ask, "Which one of these techniques should I do first?" Or, "If I can teach my teachers to do only one, which will make the biggest difference?" For the reasons I've described above, the single most powerful technique in this book is, I believe, cold call. But while making a habit of calling on students regardless of whose hand is up is one of the most critical techniques you can use to drive universal achievement, all cold calling is not equally effective. You can do it wrong. Doing it right will ensure that it has the effect you intended. The success of the technique relies on the application of a few key principles. Cold call is predictable. Cold calling is superb preventive medicine, but less effective as a cure. It is a way to keep students' attention from drifting, but it is not as effective once they're off task. It's an engagement strategy, not a discipline strategy. When a stimulus is predictable, it changes behavior by anticipation, not just by reaction. If you cold call for a few minutes of your class almost every day, students will come to expect it and change their behavior in advance. They will prepare to be asked questions at any time by paying attention and readying themselves mentally. If your cold calls surprise students, they may learn a lesson. Darn, I should have been ready. But this will be too late to help them. Unless they know there'll surely be a next time very soon, they won't have cause to change their behavior before you ask your question. They may also feel ambushed, caught off guard, and therefore more likely to be thinking about the past, why'd she do that, than about the future. I'm going to be ready. If cold calls are predictable and students begin to anticipate them, the effect will be universal. The possibility, indeed the likelihood, of a cold call affects all students, not just those who actually get cold called. You want students to react beforehand to the reliable possibility, not after the unpredictable fact. You want them always ready for the call that might come, not deciding after the fact to be ready for the next one. And you want all of them thinking that way. Cold calling, then, should be part of the fabric of everyday life in your class. A little bit of it every day will have a stronger effect on classroom culture than a great deal of intensive, but inconsistent or unexpected, cold calling. At some point in most lessons, students should be asked to participate regardless of whether they have raised their hands. Furthermore, since the purpose of cold call is to engage students before they tune out, many teachers find that the beginning of class is the ideal time for this technique. This allows them to set the tone for the rest of the day and engage students before they can become distracted. Cold call is preventive medicine. Take it daily to keep the symptoms from ever appearing. Cold call is systematic. Teachers who use cold call signal that these calls are about their expectations, not about individuals. They take pains to make it clear that cold calls are universal. They come without fail to everyone, and impersonal. Their tone, manner, and frequency emphasize that they are not an effort to single out any student or students. The less a cold call carries emotion, the less it seems tied to what a student has or has not done, to whether you are happy or disappointed with him, whether you think he did his homework. The message should ideally be, "This is how we do business here." The teachers interviewed for this book use cold call with an even, calm tone and spend a minimum amount of time appearing to hem and haw about which student to call on. Questions come at students quickly, clearly, and calmly, in clusters directed to multiple students, in multiple locations around the room, rather than focused on a single student or group of students in isolation. They should take in all types of students, not just those who might become off task or who are sitting in the back. After all, a cold call is not a punishment. It is a student's chance, as Colleen Driggs puts it, to shine. Some teachers emphasize the systematic nature of cold call by keeping visible charts tracking who's been called on. What could send a clearer message that everyone gets their share than a tracking system in which every name gets checked off in good time? Cold call is positive. The purpose of cold call is to foster positive engagement in the work of your class, which ideally is rigorous work. One of its benefits is that students occasionally surprise themselves with what they are capable of. They do not volunteer because they do not think they can answer, but when they are forced to try, they are happily surprised to find themselves succeeding. In so doing, they also benefit from knowing that you thought they could answer the question. You show your respect and faith in a student when you ask her to join the conversation. But this works only if your questions propose to ask students to contribute to a real conversation, rather than to catch them out and chasten them. This is the aspect of cold call that teachers are most likely to get wrong. There's part of many of us that wants to use it as a gotcha, to call on a student when we know he was tuned out, to show him that fact, or prove some sort of a lesson to him. "What did I just say, John?" Or, "Isn't that right, John?" But this rarely works, since causing a student to publicly founder on purpose and with no potential benefit at stake is more likely to make him ask questions about you. "Why is she always picking on me?" than about himself. A positive cold call is the opposite of a gotcha in two ways. First, it is substantive. "What did I just say?" is not a substantive question. It's a gotcha designed to teach a lesson, that in fact it rarely teaches. Do you think Lincoln declared war on the South primarily to eradicate slavery? Is a real question. What is the subject in this sentence? Is a real question. You might ask a peer such a question in the faculty room, and this shows that you respect the person of whom you are asking the question. Second, the goal is for the student to get the answer right, not learn a lesson by getting it wrong. You want your students to succeed, to feel good and maybe even a little surprised by that success, even while they are challenged and stretched by the healthy tension of cold call. Remember that cold call is an engagement technique, not a disciplinary technique. It keeps students on task and mentally engaged. Once a student is off task, the cold call opportunity has passed. Then you should use a behavioral technique. You can ensure a positive cold call by asking questions that pertain to the lesson and suggest you are making a genuine invitation to a student to participate in the conversation. Use cold call in an upbeat and positive tone, suggesting that you couldn't imagine a world in which a student would not want to participate. One final aspect of cold call that leads to a positive tone occasionally eludes some teachers when they aren't prepared. The question and what an answer could look like should be clear. Every teacher has had the experience of asking a student a question that in retrospect wasn't clear, where even a well-informed and engaged student wouldn't know what to say. It's doubly important to avoid this kind of question when cold calling, and many teachers address this challenge by planning their exact questions in advance and word for word as part of their lesson planning process. Cold call is scaffolded. This technique is especially effective when you start with simple questions and progress to harder ones, drawing students in, engaging them on terms that emphasize what they already know, and reinforcing basic knowledge before pushing for greater rigor and challenge. This will often require unbundling or breaking a single larger question up into a series of smaller questions. Consider this sequence from the classroom of Darrell Williams as he teaches his third graders to identify the complete sentences from among a list of several choices. Williams: read the next choice for me, please, Kyrese. Kyrese: reading from the worksheet. Have you seen a pumpkin seed? Williams: do we have a subject, Jafante? Jafante: yes. Williams: what's the subject? Jafante: you. Williams: you. Excellent. Do we have a predicate, Eric? Eric: yes. Williams: what's the predicate? Eric: seen. Williams: seen. Excellent. Is it a complete thought, Rayshon? Rayshon: yes. Williams: is that our complete sentence? Rayshon: yes. Williams: so we just keep going? What do we need to do, Shakea? Shakea: we need to look at the other two answer choices. Because that might sound right, but one of the other two might sound right too. The sequence involves calling on five students in rapid succession and follows a careful progression of increasing difficulty. The first question merely asks a student to read what's in front of him. The difficulty level is low. Williams is scaffolding. Anyone can get it right. The next question, is there a subject, is an incredibly simple yes or no question designed for the student of whom it is asked to get it right. When he does, Williams comes back with the more difficult question, what is the subject? But that question now comes on the heels of the student's previous success, and after Williams has engaged him in the process of thinking about sentence structure. After asking another student a similar sequence, he goes on to harder questions about whether the sentence is complete and what strategy students should take next in answering the question. By breaking the basic question, is it a complete sentence, into smaller parts and starting with simple questions, Williams successfully engages students and ensures their readiness when he asks more difficult questions. By parsing the question out to five students instead of one, he also ensures fuller participation and the expectation that participation is a predictable and systematic event. A more subtle method of scaffolding is to allow students to begin answering cold calls about work that they have already done and have the answers in front of them. This again begins the sequence with something they are likely to get right. Darrell Williams began his sequence of cold call above with a request to Kyrese to read the next answer choice for me. This engages the student at the outset at a level where he is almost sure to succeed. He merely has to read what's in front of him. Furthermore, a cold call that asks a student, "Please tell us your answer to the first problem, Milagros," employs scaffolding because Milagros has done the work and has an answer in front of her. She begins by merely reporting back on her work. Of course, a sequence that begins with such simple questions would ideally progress to more rigorous follow-up questions that did ask Milagros or Kairis to think on their feet. One of the misperceptions some teachers have about this technique is that it is only a way to ask simple questions. But its questions should be as rigorous as you can make them, something students will come to take pride in as they see themselves able to handle demanding material on the spur of the moment. Starting simple doesn't mean ending that way, but it does tend to engage and motivate kids and cause students to be inspired by the building level of rigor and challenge. Using cold call to follow up on previous comments in class underscores how much you value students' participation and insight. It also emphasizes that your students' engagement in what their peers say is as important as their engagement in what you say. There are three varieties to consider. Follow on to a previous question. Ask a simple question using cold call, think of it as a warm-up, and then ask the student a short series of further questions, most teachers ask 2 to 4, in which her opinions are further developed or her understanding further tested. Follow on to another student's comment. This reinforces the importance of listening to peers as well as teacher. James says the setting is a dark summer night. Does that tell us everything we need to know about the setting, Susan? Or, what does exploit mean, Stephen? Good, and who gets exploited in Macbeth, Marquisha? Follow on to a student's own earlier comment. This signals that once the student has spoken, she's not done. But Yolanda, you said earlier that we always multiplied length and width to find area. Why didn't we do that here? Beyond these principles, there are several elements champion teachers apply, vary, and adapt to maximize the benefit of cold call in a wider variety of settings. These are key variations in the cold call theme. Hands up, hands down. You can use cold call and continue allowing students to raise their hands if they wish, or you can instruct your students to keep their hands down. Both versions emphasize different aspects of the technique. Taking hands allows you to continue encouraging and rewarding students who ask to participate, even if you sometimes call on those who don't have their hands raised. You merely move between taking hands and cold calling at your discretion. This continues providing incentives to students to raise their hands while also allowing you to add sophistication to your scaffolding. When you're allowing hands during your cold calling, you can, say, cold call students for the first 3 questions in a sequence, and then save the capper, the last and potentially the toughest or most interesting question, for a volunteer, thus differentiating instruction and making academic challenge a reward in and of itself. One factor to consider in allowing students to raise their hands while you cold call is that it may cause your use of cold call to be less apparent and transparent, and thus less systematic. That's because it may not always be obvious to students whether the classmate who got called on had her hand up or was cold called. Taking hands also gives you an important data point. Even if you ignore it, it tells you who thinks they know well enough to volunteer. Thus, if you want to try to call on students whose mastery is unsteady, you have a clearer idea of who to try. You can also decide to tell students to put their hands down, that you're not taking hands, and then proceed to cold call whomever you wish. This sends a more forceful message about your firm control of the classroom, and it makes your cold calling more explicit, predictable, and transparent. I'm cold calling now. It also tends to make the pacing of your cold calling, and thus your lesson, even faster because you don't spend time navigating hands. Finally, hands down can be more effective for checking for understanding in 2 key ways. First, it reduces the likelihood of students calling out answers in eagerness. While truly a sin of enthusiasm, calling out is corrosive to your classroom environment and specifically to your ability to steer questions to the students who need to work or those you need to assess. Second, because students who do want to answer are rendered less visible, they don't have their hands up, your decision to target your checking for understanding of more reticent students is less patently visible and therefore seems a bit more systematic. A last caveat is that most champion teachers appear to use both hands up and hands down as a matter of habit, with their choice determined by the situation. One possible reason for this is that using only hands up is not as forceful and energetic, and using only hands down is a disincentive to hand-raising over the long run. With enough time, it risks convincing students not to bother raising their hands at all, since doing so is never rewarded. In that case, a teacher had better really like cold call because she'll have few hands offered and few alternatives. Timing the name. Cold call can vary in terms of when you say the name of the student you're calling on. The most common and often the most effective approach is to ask the question, pause, and then name a student. As in, what's 3 times 9? Pause. James? Using this sequence, question, pause, name, ensures that every student hears the question and begins preparing an answer during the pause you've provided. Since students know a cold call is likely but not who will receive it, every student is likely to answer the question, with one student merely called on to give their answer aloud. In the example, it means that every student in the class has done the multiplication in the pause between question and name. If you say the name first, 24 fewer students practice their multiplication. The difference in leverage between this scenario, 25 students answering a question and one saying it aloud, and the alternative, one student answering a question and 24 watching, is so dramatic that it should be the default approach to most of your cold calling. In some cases, calling a student's name first can be beneficial. Often it can prepare a student to attend and increases the likelihood of success. This can be especially effective with students who may not have been cold called before, students who have language processing difficulties, or students whose knowledge of English is still developing. In its most exaggerated form, this is known as a pre-call. In a pre-call, you tell a student that he or she can expect to be called on later in the lesson. It can happen privately. A teacher might say to a student before class, "Okay, Jamal, I'm going to ask you to go over the last problem from the homework today. Be ready." Or publicly, "Paul's going to give us the answer, Karen, but then I'll be asking you why." Another instance in which it is productive to state the name first is for clarity. For example, if you are coming out of a sequence of call and response, the following technique in this chapter, in which students have been calling out answers in unison, dropping in a name first and then asking the question makes it clear to students that you are no longer using call and response, and thus avoids the awkward and counterproductive moment when some students attempt to answer in unison a question you had intended for an individual. Mix with other engagement techniques. Cold call responds especially well to mixing with other engagement techniques. Call and response is a perfect example, moving back and forth between the whole group choral response and individual responses at a rapid, energetic pace can drive up the level of positive energy dramatically. It can also allow you to ensure that students aren't coasting during call and response. To take a simple example, you could review multiplication tables with your students by asking everyone to call out answers to a few problems. Teacher: Class, what's 9 times 7? Class: 63. Teacher: Good, what's 9 times 8? Class: 72. Teacher: Good, now Charlie, what's 9 times 9? Charlie: 81. Teacher: Good, what's 9 times 9, class? Class: 81. Teacher: Good, and Matilda, what was 9 times 7 again? Matilda: 63. By toggling back and forth, you can cause individual students to review material or reinforce a successful answer by having the class repeat it. Pepper, technique 24 later in this chapter, is another engagement technique that works well with cold call. In fact, it's very similar to cold call in that it consists of rapid-fire questions that are often cold called. Finally, everybody writes, technique 25 later in this chapter, is a preparation for cold call as it allows everyone to pre-think the topic or questions you'll be addressing. This increases the likely quality of responses. Teachers often conclude that cold call questions must be simple. In fact, cold call questions can and should be rigorous and demanding. Part of their power lies in having students feel the pride of answering demanding questions at the spur of the moment. Following is a transcript of a session of cold call executed by Jesse Rector of North Star Academy's Clinton Hill campus. Rector is an exceptional math teacher with exceptional results and a following within our organization for his craft. The rigor of his questioning shows why. See how many of the following cold call questions asked of seventh graders in rapid-fire succession you'd get correct. Rector, I'm a square field with an area of 169 square feet. What's the length of one of my sides, Janae? Janae, 13. Rector, 13 what? Asking Janae for the units is an example of format matters, technique 4. Janae, 13 feet. Rector, I'm a square field with a perimeter of 48 feet. What's my area, Katrina? Katrina, 144 square feet. Rector, excellent. I'm a regular octagon with a side that measures 8x plus 2. What is my perimeter, Tamise? Tamise, 64x plus 16. Rector, excellent. I'm an isosceles triangle with two angles that measure 3x each. What is the measure of my third angle, Anaya? Anaya, 180 degrees minus 6x. Rector, excellent. 180 degrees minus 6x. The square root of 400 is what, Frank? Frank, 100. Rector, no, the square root of 400 isn't 100. Help him out. David, 20. Rector, that's right, it's 20. Tell him why. David, because if you multiply 20 by 20, you'll get 400. The first time you use cold call, your students may wonder what's going on, and with some justification. They may have never been cold called before. They may not have been in a classroom where that kind of thing happened. They might not see the connection between cold call and their getting to college, say, or they might be inclined to see it as a negative rather than a positive situation. Thus, it's a good idea to script some brief remarks, in essence a rollout speech, to use the first time with cold call. Your brief remarks can explain the what and why. This makes the exercise rational, systematic, predictable, and, with a little skill, inspiring. Technique 23. Call and response. The basic element of call and response is that you ask a question and the whole class calls out the answer in unison. It sounds simple, but when it is effectively used in all its variations, call and response can be an exceptional tool, not only to engage students, but to help them achieve. Effective call and response can accomplish three primary goals: academic review and reinforcement. Having students respond as a group ensures that everyone gets to give the answer. Everyone swings at the pitch, and the number of at-bats multiplies by 25 to 30. When an individual student gives a strong answer, asking the rest of the class to repeat that answer is also an effective way to reinforce it. The whole class repeats the insight and reinforces for the original student how important what he or she said was. High energy fun. Call and response is energetic, active, and spirited. It feels lively, like being part of a cheering crowd or an exercise class. Generally, participants like cheering in crowds and going to exercise classes because they find them energizing. Call and response can make your class similarly invigorating and make students want to be there. Behavioral reinforcement. There's an outstanding hidden benefit to call and response. Students respond to a prompt as a group, exactly on cue, over and over again. And it makes this kind of on-cue compliance public. Everyone sees everyone else doing it. You ask, they do, over and over again. Students don't see call and response as behavioral reinforcement, but it makes crisp, active, timely compliance a habit, committing it to muscle memory. This reinforces the teacher's authority and command. Although call and response is a fairly straightforward technique, it's easy to underestimate it, focusing on its most simplistic forms. Asking students to repeat aphorisms and chants, for example. In fact, there are five types or levels of call and response sequence, listed next, roughly in order of intellectual rigor, from least to greatest. 1. Repeat. In these sequences, students repeat what their teacher has said or complete a familiar phrase that he or she starts. The topic of the phrase can be behavioral. Who are we? Southside Prep. What are we here to do? To learn and achieve. Or academic. When we see a zero, the pattern, stops and begins again. The pattern stops and begins again. 2. Report. Students who have already completed problems or questions on their own are asked to report their answers back. On 3, tell me your answer to problem number 3. This version allows you to more energetically reinforce academic work once it's been completed. 3. Reinforce. You reinforce new information or a strong answer by asking the class to repeat it. Can anyone tell me what this part of the expression is called? Yes, Trayvon, that's the exponent. Class, what's this part of the expression called? Everyone has an additional active interaction with critical new content. And when a student provides the information, call and response reinforces the importance of the answer. My answer was so important, my teacher asked the whole class to repeat it. 4. Review. This asks students to review answers or information from earlier in the class or unit. Who was the first person Theseus met on the road to Athens, class? Who was the second person? And now who's the third? Or, what vocabulary word did we say meant not having enough of something? 5. Solve. This is the most challenging to do well and the most rigorous. The teacher asks students to solve a problem and call out the answer in unison. If the length is 10 inches and the width is 12 inches, the area of our rectangle must be how many square inches, class? The challenge is that when having a group of people solve a problem in real time and call out the answer, there must be a single clear answer and a strong likelihood that all students will know how to solve it. With those caveats in mind, this type of call and response can be highly rigorous, and students often surprise themselves at their ability to solve problems in real time. To be effective in any form, call and response should be universal. That is, all students should respond. To ensure that this is the case, plan to use a specific signal. Class, everybody, 1, 2, or even a nonverbal signal such as a finger point, to indicate your desire to have students respond in unison. Such a signal, called an in cue, makes it clear when you are asking students to call out as a group and when you are asking for students to wait until you've identified a student to answer. This is critically important. Every student should know whether a question you've asked is rhetorical, is 42 divided by 7 going to be 5, about to be directed to a single child, 42 divided by 7 is what, Shane? Awaiting a volunteer. Who can tell me what 42 divided by 7 is? Asked in anticipation of full class call and response. Class, 42 divided by 7 is... If students don't know how to quickly and reliably differentiate your expectations in these four cases, you will lose your ability to intentionally use any of these techniques at your sole discretion. Instead, it will fall to each member of the class to infer which of the above he or she thinks is, or would like to have, applicable at any time. If that happens, you lose your ability to choose between checking for understanding with specific individual students using cold call, engaging all students, reinforcing an eager hand raiser, choosing just the student you think will be insightful, ensuring wait time for reflection before you take an answer, or any of a dozen other tricks of good teaching. In short, you need to have students know what kind of answer you expect. Furthermore, who doesn't shudder at the thought of being at a party speaking loudly over music when all of a sudden the music goes silent and they alone are left shouting their thoughts to a suddenly quiet room? For students to participate enthusiastically in call and response, they must confidently and clearly know when to sing out, because everyone will be singing out, and know as well they need not fear they will be the only one singing. Thus, for call and response to succeed, you must use a reliable and consistent signal and make 100% participation the rule. A good in cue is the key to achieving this, so it's worth spending a little more time on the topic. There are 5 specific kinds of in-cues that champion teachers use. The first kind of in-cue is count-based. For example, ready, set, 1, 2, or 1, 2, ready, you. These have the advantage of giving students time to get ready to answer, and in classrooms where call and response is especially energetic, to breathe in and prepare to sing out in their loudest voice. They also help you ensure that students answer in unison and exactly on cue, so these prompts can be particularly effective in building a strong, positive culture. Count-based cues are highly effective in that they can be cut short if students are not fully attentive or on task in the lead-up to the call and response. In other words, a count of 1, 2, ready, you, can occasionally be cut off by the teacher. 1, 2, no, I don't have everyone, to show students they're not ready while maintaining the anticipation of the fun that's to come. Finally, you can speed them up or slow them down as necessary to set the pace you desire. Effective teachers may start with a longer count-based cue and gradually truncate it as students become familiar with it to save time. 1, 2, ready, you, may become simply 1, 2. The resulting saved second of class time speeds up the pace of instruction and allocates more time to teaching. That may sound trivial, but an in-cue that's a second shorter, repeated 10 times a day over 200 days, buys you half an hour of instructional time. In some classrooms, even this shorter version is sometimes replaced by a nonverbal cue to expedite it. A second form of in-cue is the group prompt. Two common examples are everybody and class, as in, what's the name of the answer to an additional problem, everybody? Or, class, what's the greatest common factor of 10 and 16? Using a collective term for the whole class helps foster group identity, and these prompts remind students of your expectation. Saying the word everybody reminds students that you expect universal participation, and should you fail to get it, allows you to repeat the sequence by merely repeating the word with slightly greater emphasis. Everybody. Champion teachers are often strategic about whether they put the prompt before the question or after. Saying, what's the name of the answer to an additional problem, everybody, gives students time to hear and process the question before they answer, especially if there's a slight pause between question and prompt. This carries a slightly different emphasis from, everybody, what's the name of the answer to an additional problem? The former starts with the content, the latter with the expectation about who's going to answer. A third kind of in-cue is a nonverbal gesture, a point, a hand dropped from shoulder height, a looping motion with the finger. These have the advantage of speed and don't require you to interrupt the flow of the lesson. If used consistently, they can be powerful. They can also be challenging in that the tone has to be just right or they can seem schoolmarmish. Imagine how a teacher snapping when she wants her class to answer aloud could sound wrong. At the same time, I have seen teachers use this method with great success. It's also easy to slip on consistency with nonverbal signals, a tendency that can give rise to long-term challenges. Nevertheless, this is the choice of many top teachers. A fourth kind of in-cue employs a shift in tone and volume. The teacher increases volume in the last few words of a sentence and inflects his or her tone to imply a question. Students recognize this as a prompt and respond crisply. This method is by far the trickiest in cue and the most prone to error. It's often one the teachers begin using after mastering the simpler methods over time. It has the advantage of being seamless, fast, and natural, but you probably shouldn't use this as you are developing this skill. Furthermore, if you rely on it, you should expect a certain number of miscues to occur. In that case, you should have an in-cue of one of the above types ready as a backup to use to respond if students miss a cue. The last kind of in-cue is specialized. It indicates a specific response to students. In many classrooms that use these, there are multiple such cues, each indicating a different response. For example, Bob Zimmerly teaches his students a song listing the multiples of all the numbers up to 12. After he has taught them these songs, he can prompt them with specialized cues. If he says, for example, 7's on 2, 1, 2, his students will respond by singing 7, 14, 21, 28, 35, 42, to the tune of a popular song. If he says 8's on 2, 1, 2, his students will respond with a different song and different numbers. Or in a different example, you might teach your students to always respond to the in-cue, why are we here, with the response, to learn, to achieve. Once the students learned that connection, you would no longer have to offer a reminder that you were expecting a response. Ready, everyone? You would suddenly say, "Why are we here?" and your students would be chanting. This form of enkyu can be especially fun for teachers and students. There's something exciting about a teacher asking a seemingly innocuous question, and then suddenly the whole class is singing and chanting in unison. Teachers have developed a wide variety of wrinkles that add value to call and response and make it useful in particular situations. Here are three especially effective ways to adapt and apply this technique. Combine and intersperse it with cold call. Varying group and individual accountability to answer increases students' level of attention and taps into the tension of the unexpected, making class more exciting for students. Jazz up your call and response by asking subgroups within the class to respond in unison to some cues. For example, ask the boys a call and response question, and then the girls, the left side of the room, and then the right, the front, and then the back. This unexpected twist makes the technique more interesting and unexpected for students, factors that are likely to engage them more fully in class. Add a physical gesture. Students cross their fingers in a mock addition sign as they call out the name for the answer to an addition problem. The product. They point their fingers at the sky and chant, "On the roof," when asked where the numbers they carry go in an addition problem. By sometimes including a physical gesture, teachers gain two advantages. They give students a way to be physically active in class, which keeps them alert and moving, and gives them something positive to do, not just say. For students who struggle to sit still, this is a great relief. By adding a visual cue, especially one that's not random but where the gesture reflects the correct answer, the crossed fingers, the teacher is better able to watch for students who are hiding while others participate and increases his ability to assess students' level of understanding. Effectively implemented, call and response can engage all students at once in an exciting, energetic, and motivating activity that energizes the class. It is extremely useful as part of a larger engagement strategy, and it has positive ancillary behavioral effects. It builds the habit of compliance in a subtle but powerful way. When they participate in call and response, students make a habit of doing what the teacher has asked, over and over again, without even realizing they are practicing that skill. However, call and response has risks and downsides that every teacher should be aware of. It can allow freeloading. If I don't know the answer or don't want to participate, I can move my lips and fake it. If you're concerned about freeloading, consider adding a gesture to the response, which gives both an auditory and a visual way to test for participation. It does not provide effective checking for understanding. In the excitement of many students answering correctly, students who are lost can easily hide, mouthing answers or watching their peers and joining in for second and third repetitions. It reinforces the behavioral culture in your classroom only if it's crisp. If students sense that they can use their responses to test your expectations by dragging out their answers, answering in a silly or loud manner, or answering out of sync, they will. Therefore, you must make sharpening up a priority. When the response to your call is any of those, you should energetically and positively correct with something like, "I like your energy, but I need to hear you respond right on cue. Let's try that again." Technique 24. Pepper. For decades, baseball players have warmed up for games and practices by playing a game called Pepper. In a group of four or five players, one holds a bat, and the rest stand in a ring in front of the batter a few yards away, gloves at the ready. One player tosses the ball to the batter. Without stopping to catch it, the batter taps it back toward the group using the bat. The nearest